Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's show is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, sharing nothing but the best in whole grain nutrition and committed to their mission of good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
That's right. Yes, it is. It's Monday. It is 12:01. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I am your host, Katie Kiefer, and we are broadcasting live from the Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Welcome to the show, folks. We have a very interesting, really interesting guest today. You know that company that we all rail against called Monsanto? We're going to be talking all about glyphosate today because glyphosate is suddenly very much in the news again. And our guest, Carrie Gillum, is going to tell us all about it. But before that, there's this. Joys and sorrows, you know, my little news segment, which at this point is almost always sorrow. But, you know, like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do, people? Huh? I don't know. Anyway, first up in my joys and sorrows segment is the Bloomberg News reports that consumer advocacy groups are suing Sanderson Farms Poultry for ketamine in their quote unquote natural chickens. And there is the interesting part because they are not suing because there is ketamine and a host of other undesirable drug residues that were found in the chickens, but because the Sanderson label advertises them as all natural. And that's a label that has no universal definition and is thus abused regularly by food companies. Now, why those companies think it's okay for humans to be eating food that is tainted with potentially dangerous drugs is another story, and one which we will be discussing in a few moments, though certainly with a slightly different set of consequences because we're going to be talking about Roundup. But the end product is the same. Why are companies willfully using chemicals that have the probability of causing harm even when they know better? That's where the EPA is supposed to protect us, and somehow it doesn't seem to be doing much of a job, as you will soon find out. Second up is John Oliver, the television, you know, English television comedian, Last Week Tonight, who is really so smart and so funny and so on the money. He is being sued by the Murray Energy Company, which is a coal company. And that is because he dared to name them as basically the poster child for bad practices. And I will say no more about that because who knows? It's possible the company is freaking looking for people to sue, scanning, you know, their name is probably in the Google search thing. And as soon as it comes up, I will probably be the next victim here. But this kind of lawsuit, and they sued the New York Times last month, by the way, for sort of the same reasons. But this kind of lawsuit is probably something that will happen more and more as the oligarchy cements its power over us. The suit would be funny if it weren't so scary. I mean, imagine the money that HBO is going to have to spend to defend themselves from this suit. So don't tell on me, folks. You have never heard of this story from me, because we don't want to have Heritage Radio Network bogged down in a lawsuit from some crazy lunatic named James Murray, who runs the Murray Energy Company. And by the way, that was the company that was they were sued because they, you know, had unbelievably disastrously unsafe practices in their mining, operations, and were just simply outraged when people died, and then claimed, they made up a story that there was an earthquake and that's why the mine collapsed, not because they had unsafe practices. Okay. Anyway, the Raleigh News and Observer has noted that some major staffing cutbacks are planned at the EPA Research Triangle in North Carolina. And that is important for the following reason, which, just recently made headlines, and this is an ongoing story, and there's also another sort of corollary story in Ohio, which I think I mentioned at the end of the segment here. Anyway, it was discovered that a chemical called GenX, G-E-N-X, which is used for making Teflon, they have been pouring GenX into local river, the Cape Fear River, which is the local drinking water for Wilmington, North Carolina, and a number of others. Monkey Junction, believe it or not, that's the actual name of this of the town in North Carolina, and another place. Anyway, the chemical is very little studied, and it has been used in substitution for another even more toxic chemical, which I'm going to tell you about in a second, that has been dumped into the Ohio River drinking water supply. Anyway, it was substituted for that, and they've been using it for 35 years, and... The Star, in an editorial in the Star Observer, the local paper in Wilmington, North Carolina, the company was quoted as dubbing this chemical, GenX, as a byproduct rather than as a manufacturing tool. And the reason that they are doing that, well, I'll tell you in a second. But anyway, the chemical company Chemours, the official said that GenX found in the river is likely the product of a vinyl ether process that takes place elsewhere in the sprawling industrial park site. And that process has been in place at Fayetteville Works since 1980. And the GenX leaking into the Cape Fear is totally unregulated because it is a byproduct of another process. Isn't that neat? Isn't that such a cool way of circumventing a regulation, calling it a byproduct rather than a principal manufacturing product? Anyway, the terms of a federal consent order allowing Chemours to make GenX requires the company to keep 99% of any emissions from that production from escaping, but exempts the same chemical from any such restrictions when produced as a byproduct in a separate process. I think I just feel like it's amazing. Like a lawyer who thought that up is worth his weight in gold. So cutting the staff at the EPA in North Carolina at this very moment is no doubt a breath of fresh air for the corporate structures, but undoubtedly very alarming to residents. Let's keep track of this one, folks. The company that makes GenX, Chemours, and DuPont, who buys it to make Teflon and other products, settled a class action suit recently in Ohio for over $670 million over pollution from the chemical PFOF that GenX replaces in North Carolina. And I saw a headline about that Ohio settlement and the Ohio, I guess there is still ongoing litigation around that because that was in the Times today. So these major polluting industries are really sort of getting, you know, away with murder because we are basically losing all of the clout of the EPA. So without further ado, one more thing I wanted to mention is, did you notice that the U.S. has banned Brazilian beef from the United States? This is in the wake of a two-pronged scandal that is going on in Brazil at their meat packers. One is that their beef, the beef from various meat packers, including JBS, which owns numerous plants in the United States, was found to be both harboring high content of pathogens, many multi-drug resistant ones, no doubt. And then the sort of ongoing scandal in which it turns out that JBS, the two brothers who were running JBS, the Batista brothers, Wesley and Joely, they are under indictment for bribing the Brazilian government, no doubt to allow them to get away with these really crappy food safety issues. So, but let's jump to our sponsor drop, and we'll be right back with Carrie Gillum. We're going to be talking about Monsanto and her new book, and I'm very excited to welcome her to the show. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
All you superficial rappers will cease to exist if I come into a party hitting raps like this. Bob's Red Mill is a proud sponsor of Heritage Radio Network and a big supporter of organic farmers. Ray and Tom Williams are two farmers who have worked with Bob for years and co-own an organic farm in Eastern Oregon and Washington. Ray shares what their relationship with Bob's Red Mill means to them.
We thought that for over the long term, we thought it would make sense, better sense for the soil. Also, we thought that it was something that would improve the quality of the food supply. We're lucky in that we're working with Bob's Red Mill. We're part of a regional food network. With Bob is a fundamental relationship and cornerstone to that. We also work with other best-of-class people in the Northwest, and we're thankful for the long-term relationship that's brought good things to the soil and good things to our long-term farm economic plans. We appreciate his attitude toward absolutely high standard for the benefit of his customers. We take pride in meeting those standards.
Learn more about Bob's Red Mill and their commitment to good food for all at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
I'm not sure Bob's has ever been, played to a rap track. Nice one, Mike. I like that. And thank you to Bob's. We love Bob's Red Mill. So welcome to my show, Carrie Gillum. Let me read your bio. Am I saying your name right? G-I-L-L-A-M.
Yes, you are. Gillum. Okay, you got it right. Thanks,
okay,
Katie.
Excellent. So here is your bio, which of course is the kind of bio that makes me feel incredibly inadequate and insecure. But I'm going to read it anyway, because that's the kind of person I am. Carrie Gillum is a veteran journalist, researcher, and writer with more than 25 years of experience in the news industry covering corporate America. We love you. Since 1998, Gillum's work has focused on digging into the big business of food and agriculture. As a former senior correspondent for Reuters International News Service and current research director for consumer group U.S. Right to Know, a group that I feel we need to know better, Gillum specializes in finding the story behind the spin, uncovering both the risks and the rewards of the evolving new age of agriculture. Gillum's areas of expertise include biotech, crop technology, agrochemicals, and pesticide product development, and the environmental impacts of American food production. And folks, her new book is Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. Welcome to the show, Carrie, and thank you for writing that book, which I cannot wait to read, and I can't believe I didn't get a copy of it. They're going to have to send it to me so we can do an interview about it.
Yes.
After
it
the
comes
show.
Out October 10th.
Great.
Thank you so much for having me here. I tell people I'm a bit of a glyphosate geek now.
Oh, yeah.
Because I've spent so many years researching that.
Yeah. I love people who geek out about stuff. I happen to be a geek about the meat industry. So I totally get the geek thing. Before we get into the Roundup story, I wanted to ask, I don't know if you heard how much of my Joys and Sorrows segment, but I've been looking into the story of the pollution of Cape Fear by the Chemours chemical company. They've been dumping
right.
this product, Gen X, into the river for 35 years, as it turns out. And then when they were taxed about it, apparently they were able to fix that in 5 days. I don't know if you, there was an incredible editorial
yeah.
in the Wilmington Star Observer that was just like, oh my God, really? You've been polluting people for 35 years? And they really don't know what impact. And my nephew has been living in Wilmington for the last 4 years. You can imagine his family and himself were a little disturbed to hear that he had been sucking up Teflon chemicals along with his H2O. But I was wondering what your take on that was. And also the Times had a piece today about the PFOF, I think is the name of the chemical that also that Gen X was supposed to replace in Ohio, in the Ohio River Valley. And that they made a big settlement of like $670 million over that. But evidently there's some litigation still going because I saw a piece about it in the Times today. Which I didn't.
Right. PFOA. Right.
Thank you. PFOA. Thanks.
Yeah.
I knew I had that wrong.
No, you're right. I mean, my response, my reaction is I guess, the same it's been year after year. I mean, this happens all the time. It's happened for decades, and it's going to continue to happen, right? We've seen it with PCBs. We've seen it with asbestos.
Sure.
We've seen it with PFOA. We're seeing it with this new PFOA substitute. These companies make billions and billions of dollars off of these chemicals.
Yeah.
And, discharging waste in surface waters that go into flow into people's drinking water, you know, is poisonous and is dreadful for us to think about. But for companies, they've shown it's really just a cost of doing business. Eventually, they get caught. Eventually, they pay out, you know, less than $1 billion
right.
in settlements, and they go on their way. And they typically do what DuPont did here. They'll set up a separate company and spin off, you know, their liability into that company and then blame that company. And you saw it with Monsanto and Solutia, you know, and some of their industrial chemical problems. So,
well, you're going to tell us about that in just a second.
But, I mean, this is the way we allow our chemical companies to do business in America. And, you know, they make a lot of money. They employ a lot of people. It's a risk-reward ratio. And, you know, a lot of people get hurt.
It kind of goes back to, like, what I was talking about at the beginning of my segment when over the weekend, I saw a piece about, I'm sorry to get off track for a minute, but we're going to do it anyway, that there's ketamine and all kinds of other, I mean, I've been following the meat industry for, you know, close to a decade. And, you know, of course, one is aware of things like, you know, beta agonists and the antibiotics and the antibiotic resistant bugs. But there was, I hadn't realized that they were treating, for instance, chickens with ketamine and that there was significant amounts of residue in the Sanderson Farms ketamine, chickens. And I was thinking to myself, like, this, that's part of the same continuum that you're talking about with the chemical companies. The food companies are doing essentially the same thing. And we'll talk about how Roundup is in, you know, basically all of our bodies now. But the thing that blows my mind about this, Carrie, is that, you know, yes, I understand seeking a profit. I understand trying to make as much money as you can. But I don't understand willfully poisoning people even when you know you're doing it. Like, I get it if you're not aware. But, you know, some of these things you can't possibly ignore, and they just continually ignore them, just like, you know, the meat companies ignore the effluent from hog farms. I mean, it's just, I don't understand. I don't understand why we haven't all had a tremendous revolution. I think that's what we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's talk about glyphosate, because you are obviously the Mac mommy of glyphosate research.
Which I'm not sure I tell my husband when I die and they put that on my headstone. You know, she knew a lot about a weed killer. Like, you know.
I think, you know, given what's happening now and the kinds of stories you've been writing just recently and the class action suit that's taking place out in California, I think that's going to be a really swell epitaph to have. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about how it was that glyphosate was approved by the EPA and how it has now become the world's most popular herbicide? Because this goes back 30 years or so, right?
Well, yeah, glyphosate came on the market in 1974. Mm-hmm. Monsanto patented it and introduced it as an herbicide, and everybody loved it. It was, you know, France, the chemist at Monsanto who synthesized it, you know, got an award for it, and people loved it. Farmers all around the world loved it because it could kill these harmful weeds so much quicker and easier, right, than any of the herbicides that have been on the market before. And so Monsanto, you know, trailed along there. It was approaching patent expiration in the year 2000. I'm skipping over the regulatory part here. We can go back to that.
We're going to go back to that, yeah.
Highly controversial. But it was in the year 2000. The patent was expiring, so Monsanto brilliantly in the 1990s rolled out a series of crops designed to tolerate being sprayed with glyphosate, right? And these were Roundup-ready crops to go with Monsanto's Roundup herbicide. And Monsanto was very strategic. They told their investors at that time, we're going to see a skyrocketing use of glyphosate because of this. And they did. And glyphosate use has surged over the past several years. You know, over decades, there were about 18 million pounds used in 1991 of glyphosate in the United States. You know, in 2015, it was 286 million pounds.
Holy smokes. I mean,
that's a giant, it's
that's
the
incredible.
Most widely used agricultural chemical in the world.
Wow.
So it's a big deal.
Yeah,
you know?
It's very big.
And it's not just used on GMO crops. It's also sprayed directly on wheat, which is not genetically modified. It's sprayed directly on oats and some beans, lentils, and things like that to help them dry out shortly before harvest. So the result is there's a heck of a lot of this in our food production system and a heck of a lot of it in the food that we're eating, you know, every day, presumptively, because there's, the government has decided not to do thorough testing for residues of glyphosate in our food, even though they test for virtually every other commonly used pesticide that they've decided glyphosate wouldn't be tested for. But,
and do you have a theory about why that might be?
You can be cynical, or you know, the USDA and the FDA, who annually do testing. I think the FDA has done it for 30 some years, and USDA for about 25 years.
Yeah.
Every year, thousands of foods, hundreds of different herbicides, insecticides, fungicides, etc., never test for glyphosate, and they say it's because, number one, glyphosate is so safe. Hey, you know, who cares if it's in your food? Super safe.
Right.
And number two, really, really expensive to test for glyphosate. Really hard to test for glyphosate.
Just so hard. When we have how many millions of dollars in profit, perhaps, have we made this year? I don't know, but anyway.
Yeah. So, you know, but, and we can talk more about that if you want. I mean, they're clearly, the FDA actually did, after a lot of, you know, pressure from people like me and consumer groups, and then the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which said that glyphosate is a probable human carcinogen. The FDA did say in 2016, okay, you know what, we will start testing foods for glyphosate residues. A little bit. We'll do a limited special project, they said. Started that project, got it underway, stopped the project. That was about in February 2016. They halted the project by September 2016. They said they were having internal difficulties. It, coincidentally or not, came after an FDA chemist found a whole lot of glyphosate throughout, pervasive in U.S. honey supplies that he pulled.
Oh, my gosh.
Even organic honey. Right. And he found it in very high levels in oatmeal products, particularly in baby food oatmeal products.
Fabulous.
So, you know, so the FDA suspended the program. They just now in June have said they're going to restart the program to try to get a handle on glyphosate residues in foods. But, you know, we'll see.
We'll see. Oh, my God. So let's jump to the fact that there is a really large, with over 100 defendants, if I'm not mistaken, in a class action suit against Monsanto by people who believe that they have been that their exposure to glyphosate has resulted in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Right.
Tell us
right.
a little bit about that suit, because then our the rest of our conversation sort of follows from that.
Sure. And of course, the lawsuits are a direct result of the International Agency for Research on Cancer's declaration, which came in March of 2015, that glyphosate was a probable human carcinogen. The most positive association to any disease, to any cancerous cause or disease, is to non-Hodgkin lymphoma. That's what the research shows. And of course, some people get confused. IARC did not do its own research. What IARC does is they look at relevant published research, you know, what they consider to be the most robust and relevant research. And that's what they did. They looked at years and years and years and years of epidemiology and toxicology research. It had all been published and peer-reviewed, and they came to this conclusion that the weight of evidence showed it was a probable human carcinogen. Not definite,
right.
You know, not possibly, but probably. And so, you know, that's when these lawsuits started to be filed. People who'd been using Roundup, who suffered, you know, terrible different forms. You know, it's a blood cancer, essentially, and it can manifest itself in many different ways. And many people have suffered horrible, horrible, you know, disease and death. Yeah. And so there are now there are 1,100 plaintiffs, roughly, that have filed in state courts. And then there are currently 90 lawsuits, and I've lost track of the plaintiffs, 91 lawsuits that are combined in what they call multi-district litigation. They don't call it class action. They call it multi-district litigation.
Thank you.
And that's being handled out in federal court in San Francisco right now. But they keep transferring a lot of these state cases. And, you know, that is the potential. I mean, the DuPont PFOA was multi-district litigation, you know, and it was 3,000 lawsuits. So, you know, this certainly seems like where we're headed with the Roundup litigation.
Yeah, absolutely. In other words, divest yourself of Monsanto stock?
I don't know. If they were paid out $670 million, it wouldn't really be much of a dent.
That's true. It's a drop in the bucket. Now, there was a study in 1983 called A Chronic Feeding Study of Glyphosate in Mice. And this was kind of a major deal because they went back and looked at this study and they resectioned the tumor or the tissues that they had taken from the mice. And they turned up more tumors than had been originally reported. Am I getting that right?
Sort of. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
So the reason that I have focused on this and written about this recently is this could be pivotal in the MDL litigation in California, but it also really illustrates how the science has been manipulated and sort of reinterpreted to favor Monsanto. So this was a study that Monsanto paid to have done. It was not published. It was a secret, secret information that Monsanto turned over to the EPA. They had to turn it over because they told the EPA it was coming, right? Mm-hmm.
Right.
Sadly, and the EPA, Monsanto, when they turned it over, it showed a very clear dose response, glyphosate triggering tumors in mice. The control group, the mice who did not get glyphosate, didn't get any tumors. Uh-huh. But the mice who did got tumors. Statistically significant finding, dose response finding. So they gave this to the EPA, and they sent a letter, and they said, you know what, but you really can discount those tumors in those mice because we really don't think they're related to glyphosate. They just got them naturally. And the EPA toxicologist looked at this. You can see this through all these memos and documents from that time that we've obtained. The EPA toxicologist said, no. That's nuts. That makes no sense. This clearly, shows a carcinogenic response. So they decided to, in 1985, the EPA said, yeah, we're going to say this is probably carcinogenic. It looks like it is. Monsanto fought tooth and nail for years and years and years to get them to change their view on that. And they hired another pathologist, and that pathologist went back, and that's what you're talking about. The hired pathologist from Monsanto went back and found tumor in the control group of mice. So that supported Monsanto's notion.
Oh, I see, that they were naturally occurring.
That it wasn't dose response.
Right.
And the EPA still said, no, we don't see it. That's crazy. And so there's been this ongoing, well, is there or isn't there? And so in the lawsuit now, the plaintiff's attorneys have said, hey, well, we want to see those mouse tissue slides, and we'll have somebody look at them again. And, of course, Monsanto didn't want them to, but the judge said they could. So that's where we are with that. But it's telling that in rat studies, mice, dogs, rabbits, you can look at the, extensive amount of research that's been done, and these laboratory animals come, they have reproductive issues, they have tumors, they, have different disease indicators when they're exposed to glyphosate Roundup. There's been a large body of evidence that's come together, which is why IARC determined, as it did, probable human carcinogen.
Right, right. Because your piece referenced a number of studies which, to me, were huge red flags. In 1981, even before the one you're talking about, the mouse study, they saw cancer of the testes
study.
In rats. And then in 1990, they saw thyroid cancer as well in female rats or mice. Why do you think, why were those suppressed or ignored? How did they get away with hiding that information from the EPA? I'm just kind of like, what is
that? And they didn't hide it. And this is what, and I really get into a lot of this in my book, but, none of this was hidden from the EPA. Mm-hmm. What happened was, it was sort of an internal battle. Internal EPA scientists would say, yeah, this shows, carcinogenic problems. This shows major problems. And then Monsanto would say, no, it doesn't, and here's why. And then they would argue and they would fight, and the EPA, got outside scientific advisors to weigh in on things. And they chewed on it and chewed on it for years and years and years. And, of course, political pressure comes to bear. This was a very popular product.
Yeah.
It's making a lot of money, and farmers really liked it, in the 80s and 90s. And so the EPA, you can see through the documentation how the EPA then eventually would sort of give in, and went along with this narrative that was provided by Monsanto.
I was struck by a few months ago, and I sent this to you in the outline. I'm sure you read the Daily, Ag Daily Insider, Chuck Abbott's thing.
Oh, yeah.
He's
my old
so
colleague,
great.
Chuck.
Yeah, he's a wonderful guy. Wonderful. It's a wonderful newsletter. Anyway, he had a piece about this a couple months ago that I looked up. And essentially, he reported that in 2013, one of the senior toxicologists at the EPA said in a letter to the now retired deputy director of the agency, Jess Rowland, this woman wrote, "It is essentially certain that glyphosate causes cancer," which was a direct contradiction of their 1991 ruling. And moreover, she goes on to say the following, which is, "For once in your life, listen to me and don't play your political conniving games with the science to favor the registrants. For once,
right.
Do the right thing and don't make decisions based on your bonus."
Right.
If that
right.
is not the most damning piece of evidence...
It's an incredibly damning piece of evidence. I wrote about that. It's in my book,
uh-huh.
of course. The Marion Copley letter, though, right. and I just have to say this because, you know, I'm a journalist, and, you know, unless you got it locked down, you don't know. There has yet to be authentication of that letter.
Is that right?
I've seen it. As I said, I wrote about it. I, you know, put it out there. I put it in my book. It is a very damning letter. But it's not, you know, she's dead. She died of cancer.
Right.
Her husband, you know, when this letter first surfaced to the plaintiff's attorney, got this letter sent to them,
mm-hmm.
Essentially anonymously. I got this letter sent to me. A couple other people did too, but it doesn't show any proof or any indication that it's real. So we don't know that. Now, the EPA and Monsanto have not said it's not real.
Right.
I mean, which you think they would, but her husband, when I spoke to him, Marion Copley's husband, he didn't know anything about it. He said, you know, so yeah, I mean, if it's authentic, it's a killer, but I don't know yet how that one's going to shake out. But there's definitely a lot of documentation that's come out, both from EPA and from internal Monsanto documents that have come out through discovery in the lawsuits that shows that this guy, Jess Rowland, who is a high-level guy in EPA,
yeah.
had a very seemingly cozy and friendly relationship with Monsanto, wanting to help them with the glyphosate concerns.
Right. Well, that brings me up to... we're skipping ahead a little bit here, but that brings me to your articles, your two articles, because you had one on June, I think, the 6th, which is the one that made me contact you. And then Reuters, a few days later, published an article essentially refuting the information that you had given in yours, but in a very peculiar way, which I actually found kind of difficult to understand. And what I thought was really interesting about it is that you then show in a subsequent article what the flaws are in this article by Reuters, or from Reuters, by what is her name? Kelly Kaland?
Kate Kaland.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about that, because that was fascinating, I thought.
Yeah. And I have to say, it made me uncomfortable, really, to write that article. I've never written an article that essentially tears down another reporter's work.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, for an institution I worked for 17 years, I mean, I'm still a little uncomfortable with it. But the article was such a blatant propaganda move by Monsanto, and it had to be, and it was so false and so misleading, and it had to be called out. And it has been used by Monsanto to exploit it in exactly the ways that they intended. You know, they tried to get California just last week to the appellate court to overturn this decision on glyphosate by citing this Reuters article. You know, they didn't succeed. But so essentially what happened is Dr. Aaron Blair, who was the chairman of the ARC working group, was deposed by Monsanto, I think it was late March, and it's a 300-page deposition, and the deposition goes through a lot of information about all the different studies that show problems with glyphosate and cancer and ties to cancer.
Mm-hmm.
There's one part where Monsanto asks him to talk about an unpublished, unfinished collection of data that was part of an agricultural health study. You don't need the details on that, I suppose, but unpublished, unfinished data, and why the group that he was working for didn't finish and publish that data so that IR could look at it, because it showed no connection, really, between glyphosate and non-Hodgkin lymphoma. Mm-hmm. And Aaron Blair says, well, because it wasn't finished. Like, we decided not to finish it before IARC even said they were even going to look at glyphosate. It had nothing to do with it. We were working, they were working on insecticides. They got an insecticide thing done. The glyphosate data wasn't even considered statistically significant. It was not something that they were pursuing at that time. But Reuters made this out to be a giant story about, oh, this scientist withheld, you know, yes, information, very important information from the IARC working group that would have changed the outcome of the classification, and it, you know, was critical information. And of course, if you read the deposition, you see it wasn't, and you see that the scientists didn't consider it to be and thought it was a ridiculous line of questioning because this was unpublished, unfinished data. And he talked about additional unfinished, unpublished data that showed a 2 times a doubling of risk with glyphosate to cancer, that they also didn't get to IARC because it also was unfinished and unpublished. So,
right.
I mean, it's just a completely ridiculous notion to write the story the way she did. And she said, and the thing that really got to me is she said that she essentially implied she got these from court. She said court documents.
Right.
These documents were never filed in court. So she didn't get them from court. She,
right,
got them.
She got them from Monsanto.
And we don't even know if she got all of them from Monsanto, because if she, certainly if she'd read them all, she couldn't have written the story that she did. So, you know, I did then get the documents, and because plaintiff's attorneys, once they realized Monsanto had given them to Kate, they gave them to me. They're not under seal. They're part of discovery. And I just posted them so everybody could read them for themselves,
yeah,
to see how ridiculous this Reuters story was.
Wow. Well, that brings me to something else, which I found alarming, because this woman, Kate Kelland, is part of something called the Science Media Center. And given the title of your book includes the corruption of science, I wanted you to take a second to talk a little bit about the Science Media Center, because I think that is a seriously dangerous path that we are going down. If the Science Media Center is essentially a press, you know, press relations for chemical companies to furnish newspapers and magazines with inaccurate material. So am I right in characterizing it that way, or was it just this reporter who you think could be somewhat corrupted by her associations?
The ties that we pointed out, that I pointed out, you know, it just seems odd to me. She did appear in a promotional video for Science Media Center, and there's a promotional or positive, very, you know, essay that she wrote that was published in the Science Media Center newsletter that talks about how great she thinks they are. So now that doesn't make her, you know, part of them, but it certainly shows that she, you know, is closely affiliated. Science Media Center, the largest block of funding that they get, now they get funding from foundations and from a lot of places, but the largest single block comes from companies and trade groups like Crop Life America, Monsanto, Bayer, Syngenta, you know, all the big ag chemical companies. Yeah. So you, as a journalist, would really need to be suspect about the information that they're providing, the experts they're trying to get you to talk to. Obviously, they have an agenda, but that group is only one. I mean, there are the American Council on Science and Health. I mean, there are numerous groups that have been set up and funded specifically by the chemical companies to advance their agendas. And that's what they do. And they make it look like these independent scientific organizations, you know, are acting on their own. But you got to follow the money. And and so, you know, there are so many different, you know, academics. We found university academics, you know, across the country who are getting money from Monsanto or others. And then they're talking about how great, you know, GMOs are and how safe glyphosate is. And they write editorials in newspapers that consumers read, and they go on websites and they speak to college students. They never mention that, oh, by the way, you know, we just got a check for $25,000 into my account from Monsanto. You know, they don't mention that.
No.
So
No, it's very alarming. I mean, I find the fact that so many universities are essentially beholden to large companies, especially the extension schools, the agricultural schools, are so beholden to these companies for money for research and development. Nobody is really crying about the conflict of interest inherent in that kind of funding, and you know, the fact that we really, in order to have pure science, we have to have completely independent funding for science. And that means the public has to pony up. And, you know, people, you know, no taxes. We don't want to pay any taxes. Right?
I mean, that's true. Corporate, you know, and spending for public education and higher level and research at these land-grant universities, you know, is in decline and has been in decline. And the corporations have stepped in and made some very generous, you know, they spread a lot of money around through our universities, and they get control over the research through that, and or influence, perhaps, is a better way to say that.
I think there's definitely a lot of it's more than influence. I think that information that is not beneficial. I've heard from many a university professor that research that they had worked on had been suppressed or had been. For example, there's a guy at Texas Tech named Guy Lonergan. Do you know him? He works in the works on the cattle industry, and he published a paper a few years ago about the use of ractopamine, which is a beta agonist that is used for growth promotion in hogs and cattle.
Yeah.
And he was able to show that there was a correlation in morbidity between the use of ractopamine and cattle deaths. And that study, which, you know, he spent years developing, was completely discredited by Elanco, the drug manufacturer that produces ractopamine. And his reputation was kind of smeared in industry circles, just because he had found something that they didn't like. So that study was obviously, immediately sort of countered, and if not fully suppressed, it was certainly discredited by the folks at Elanco. And that to me was just like, oh my God, wow. You know, and this guy's a straight shooter, you know, and he's, you know, it's very hard not to...
That's the playbook. I mean, you can see that. You can see it in my book. You can see it in articles people have written. That's the playbook, and it happens over and over and over. If a scientist tries to actually come out with anything that's not favorable to industry, he's going to get discredited. He's going to lose funding. It just goes on and on and on. And there's numerous, and not just scientists, journalists too.
Sure.
And, I mean, Monsanto helped set up a whole website called Academics Review that we at U.S. Right to Know got email documentation, internal records showing. You know, and they say, right, we don't want people to know we're behind this, but they wanted to set it up so that that could be a vehicle for different people to write articles tearing down journalists or scientists or others and propping up industry interests. While looking to be completely independent. So,
that's right.
You know, part of the game, part of the playbook.
Well, tell us just for a few minutes, tell us about U.S. Right to Know, because I meant to ask you that at the top of the show. And now we're at a point where we can actually talk about that because it's a good thread to follow here. Yeah. So tell us about the organization and what you're doing.
Yeah. So we're still really young, right? And really small. I just came on board in January 2016 So year and a half. And what we do really is we are trying to educate consumers and trying to give them information that they wouldn't normally get because they're so inundated with the corporate message and the advertising and the PR and the websites and the academic sort of, you know, spin and articles like Reuters. So what we try to do is not to advance the chemical industry really likes to say we're sort of some activist group or something, but we don't. Our mission is really to provide truthful and transparent information to consumers about the food system. Mm-hmm. So we file a lot of Freedom of Information Act requests. I am so awash in documents right now from the EPA, it makes my head hurt because I have 1,000 I got last week that I still have to go through today. So, you know, I file freedom of information with FDA, USDA, EPA. My colleagues file them with universities. We do research, we travel, we talk to scientists and farmers and consumers. I met with food company executives last week to really just try to bring information to consumers that they wouldn't otherwise have so that they can make informed decisions, you know, when they buy things or with policies they want to support, you know. I mean, and more power to you. It's like, you know, smoker, it's like anything else. You know, if you decide that the reward is worth the risk, and you know, that's great.
Sure.
But we think that in a democratic society, you really do need to have as much factual information, as much balance to the, you know, to these issues as possible. So that's what we're trying to do. And we were started with money from the Organic Consumers Association, but we've drawn funding now from various, you know, foundations and others who are interested in health and fitness issues and sort of environmental issues. And
how do consumers access your information and the campaigns that you are on? Can we go to a website, U.S. Right to Know, read about all of the things that you were studying?
USRTK.org, you know, www.usrtk.org. And we have a whole website looking at different things, sweeteners, you know, and children's issues, and glyphosate, of course, is a big part. The CDC and Coca-Cola and some of the, well, I mean, that's a whole other thing, you know, the beverage industry and the coziness, the CDC looking at sugar and obesity research and stuff. I mean, it's, you know, there's a price we pay in America, I think, for sort of worshiping profit and worshiping, you know, corporate advancement.
We
love capitalism, but it does, you know, unless it's balanced with pretty solid regulation, you know.
Yeah, it kind of sucks.
I mean, people can get hurt, and we're, you know, the Trump administration wants to further cut regulation and erode the EPA's ability to do things like, in, you know, take action in North Carolina to regulate glyphosate or other pesticides. They want to cut that even further. So,
well, I think, you know, a lot of it comes back to Citizens United, even, don't you think? I mean, the untrammeled flow of corporate money into the pockets of congressmen and senators, I think, has every bit of, you know, is a huge part of this problem now, because it does seem to be more now than ever. But it's also, at the same time, we seem to want to know more than ever. And so I've no doubt that your research shows that these kinds of issues have been ongoing for 30, 40 years. I mean, Maren McKenna is coming out with a new book called Big Chicken. And, you know, she's the poster child for antibiotic resistant reporting. And that goes back to the 1970s as well. I mean, you know, and your glyphosate research, and what other things have you written about that have to do with, because I've seen your byline in the Huffington Post, but I don't think I had ever seen it before in Reuters, which just shows you how ignorant I am.
No, but, well, I mean, you know, as I said, I've been a reporter for more than 25, because I don't like to actually say how long I've been, and it's always been covering corporate America, you know, banking and the healthcare industry, and I was on the campaign trail with Barack Obama in Iowa during the first campaign. And so I've been around, I've seen a lot, but farming and food is really what I've done for the last 20 years or so. And it's really important. And people, I just want to make this point. The reason people need to care is because it matters to our health and to our sustainability of our environment. There's no doubt. The EPA acknowledges, World Health Organization, American Academy of Pediatrics, all sorts of, that environmental contaminants, pesticides used in agriculture, the PFOA, the Gen X, that stuff is killing us. It's causing cancers. It's causing reproductive issues. It's fertility. It's causing children to have rising rates of autism and ADHD and neurodevelopmental issues. It's eroding the quality of our soil. It's eroding the quality of nutrition in our blood. I mean, we are literally killing ourselves because we're letting ourselves become awash in pollutants, chemical pollutants in our food, our water, our air,
and livestock, you know, everything. Yeah.
So,
Well, we should wrap it up. I want you to tell people about their about your website. Repeat the name of your book. You're going to be coming back to talk about that, because I will email you this afternoon and ask you for your publisher, your publicity department, so I can get
a
copy.
Sure, of course. No, but yeah, go to my website, www.carriegillum.com, and Carrie, C-A-R-E-Y, .gillum.com, and the book, is going to be sold through Island Press. A Washington, D.C. based publisher, and then US Right to Know, usrtk.org.
Yeah.
So
we want to know.
Send us, I'd love to hear, people do this a lot. Send me your story ideas, right? Tell me what's happening or questions you want me to ask. And,
great.
Great. So
thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
I have the feeling that we're going to be talking on a regular basis because you're just terrific on the radio. I don't know if anybody's told you that
before.
But it was really a good conversation. I enjoyed it.
That's all that matters.
As long as I'm happy. Anyway, thanks to my sponsor, Bob's Red Mill. Proud to have you aboard. And most of all, people, remember this is our summer fundraising drive. If you like this program, if you like any of the other programs on our network, there are 34 other shows. They're all great. Go to our website, press the beating heart, and give deeply of your money and your love, and especially your time in listening to the podcast. So thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care now.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.